Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My choice this week is the winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction. It's Leviathan by Philip Hoare. It's, I think we could say, a hefty book, Philip, couldn't we? Which touches on the history and literature and lore of Wales. That's Wales with an H. Tell us a bit about your fascination with Wales.
Gosh, well, I think it all started when I was a little boy and we were taken off to Windsor Safari Park to see the tame orca performing in what was actually really an overgrown swimming pool. And I think even then, you know, as a young boy, I realised it was a completely inappropriate way to keep a wild animal, let alone a sort of 16-foot killer whale. And then I suppose it sort of developed from then. But really the key point came when I was actually invited to Provincetown, which is a little old whaling port, in fact, at the end of the tip of Cape Cod. And on my last day there, I saw the sign saying whale watching, and I thought, oh wow, you know, it sort of stirred up all my old childhood memories and obsession really with whales. Went out on this whale boat, and I just not completely unprepared for the fact that sort of half an hour later, a 50-foot, 50-ton humpback whale leapt out of the water in front of me, and just suspended in midair as if for an instant, and then fell back to earth, and it's just. And that's really where it all started.
So tell me a bit about the book. I mean, you can't have expected to win a prize with this book because it's such an unusual construction, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's only actually now I'm sort of coming public on the fact that this book wasn't planned, it wasn't structured. It was, you know, I just dove in. And really, you know, there is no structure to it at all, in a way. It's just really almost stream of consciousness. And I think one of the reasons why I did that is because I felt my previous books, which had been quite sort of biography, had been constrained by dates and by birth dates, death dates. And I wanted to break free from that in a way. And I've been gradually doing that in my recent work. But now I just felt there was something about the whale that sort of enabled this. The kind of freedom of the whale, the way that it sort of is master of this environment, which we sort of have virtually no awareness of whatsoever, that seemed to lead me onto this very sort of free-form way of writing.
So freedom from gravity, then?
Very much so. And, you know, one of the other things that underlies and underpins the writing of this book is my fear of water. And now my joy in water, but I still have this fear. I didn't learn to swim until I was about 25. I was even scared to take a bath. It's kind of ridiculous, but I put it down to the fact that my mother nearly gave birth to me in a submarine when she was down to taking a submarine tour in Portsmouth. But really that the idea of challenging your fears in a way. So that, you know, actually, you know, at the end of the book, when I finally do actually get in the water with the whale, it's sort of in 3-mile deep waters off the Azores, where there really are giant squid swimming about underneath you. So it was a complete sort of confrontation of one's own fears.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the hearts of this book is Moby Dick, the story of the creation of Moby Dick, the influences on it, and of course, the book itself. Tell me a bit about that.
Gosh, well, you can't write a book about a whale or the whale without writing about Moby Dick. I mean, it looms over you sort of rather like the text itself, or rather sort of, you know, Leviathan of a book. But of course, the thing with Moby Dick is when you do come to read it, and it took me 3 goes to sort of running jumps at it before I actually ever finished it. I think probably like many other people, it's very daunting, 135 chapters of very dense 19th century prose. But then you realise it's incredibly sly and subversive and very, very funny and very wicked as well. A lot of innuendo. And so you carried along on Melville's sense of humour and his obsession as well. And that's what really carried me along too.
We had a bit of a scoop on the Guardian review, which you very kindly gave us in advance of publication, which was the story of the Tunstall whale, which your theory is that it actually influenced Melville. Can you tell us about that whale?
It absolutely is. It's the only whale mentioned in Moby Dick which actually does exist. And we sort of discovered it rotting in the grounds of a stately home in Yorkshire. And it had actually, it was a sperm whale which had been stranded on the shore near Scarborough, and it was taken in by the local lord of the manor and set up as a sort of early 19th century follies in the grounds, but it had since sort of rotted away into the grounds, and then was subsequently brought into the hall. It's on display now at Burton Constable Hall. Melville uses it as a wonderful analogy in the book, one of his very playful sort of analogies, and he talks about people taking tours of it as they would sort of St. Paul's Cathedral. But so the fact that we found the actual real bones was quite magical.
And also you found the people, the owners of the hall who had in whose possession these bones were, which is quite surreal as well.
It is, and very unusual, because there's this medieval edict which determines that any whale, dolphin, sturgeon or porpoise which is washed up on the shores of the English coast belongs to Her Majesty or His Majesty. But this right devolves to the Lord of the Manor of Burton Constable, only specifically in this part. So he actually claims any cetacean washed up on the shore.
So now we've talked a bit about the cultural history of the whale, but there's also, of course, a physical history, a material history. I wonder if you could just read a little bit which just puts the influence of this in context.
Absolutely. Children's faces were washed with whale soap, and having tied their shoelaces of whale skin, they marched off to school, past gardens nurtured on whale fertiliser, to draw with whale crayons. In her office, Big Sister transcribed memos on typewriter ribbon charged with whale ink, pausing to apply her whale lipstick. Later that afternoon, she would play a game of tennis with a whale-strung racket.
Is there a little bit of exaggeration in that?
Not at all. I mean, you and I, Claire, I mean, we were brought up in an age when there was whale oil in margarine. Stalk margarine contained whale oil. Our parents, your mother would have worn whale-based cosmetics, you know. Britain was still importing sperm whale oil for consumption in the 1960s. You know, whaling didn't end in the EU until 1986. This is a very recent thing, and I think this is one of the themes of my book, really, is that how we've very, very quickly changed from being a civilization which was whale hunting to being a civilization which is whale watching. And it's that great notion of the meeting of human history and natural history which really kind of powers my narrative, I suppose.
Mm. Tell me a bit about ambergris, which, of course, is the most prized whale product of all. What is it?
Well, it's utterly fascinating. It's actually whale poo. It's produced in the lower intestine of a whale when the beak of a squid, I mean, many sperm whales, and it's only produced in the gut of a sperm whale, they feed pretty much exclusively on squid, and the only part they can't digest is the hard beak, like a sort of parrot's beak. That gets caught in the intestine, and a kind of cholesterol forms around it called amberine. That's then expelled, excreted out, not vomited up, but at the other end. And then that matures in the water. It floats in the water, and it has this extraordinary, not only a scent of its own, but the power to capture scent as well. It looks, when not sort of matured, it looks rather sort of peaty. The smell will linger on your finger for a week. Slightly in the way patchouli oil is very, very pervasive. But this stuff is prized because it's used by perfumiers in the construction of perfumes. I mean, Givenchy, Dior, Chanel all use ambergris in their perfumes nowadays. Whales weren't hunted for it because it was very difficult to find. It's only produced in 1 in 100 whales. It would commonly be found floating on the surface of the ocean. And even now, you know,
in a bag, in like a bowel bag.
No. Actually, it's kind of a convolved, vaulted lump of sort of, I don't know what to, I mean, it does
poo.
Look like poo. I mean, I'm sorry, but it does. That's exactly what it does look like. And but a very, very wealthy and lucky piece of poo to find, because, you know, it can be worth thousands and thousands of pounds.
So were there people who went out looking for it?
Absolutely, absolutely, and still do. On the Indian Ocean, where it's commonly harvested now, it's found on beaches. And, you know, you find sort of small pieces, but sometimes very large pieces are found, and you know, the finder becomes a millionaire.
Tell me a bit more about whales in science. Whales in World War II, they had a very important role.
It's extraordinary that for such a placid animal, they were put to such a warlike use, because actually the whales were rendered down into glycerin, which was made into nitroglycerin. So they actually became the components of armaments itself. Whale oil was used to treat trench foot. Later on, nuclear submarines were designed using the hydrodynamics developed by sperm whales. So they're actually, these whale-like submarines really were mimicking whales. And then even on into the space program, where NASA actually still use whale oil in the Hubble Space Telescope and the Voyager space probe. They are flying into Earth, even as we speak, oiled by whale oil.
So is there anything a whale can't do?
Gosh, well, I don't think so. You know, I mean, I hate to take this conversation to the realms of the almost fantastical, but there's a wonderful book by a chap called Hal Whitehead, who's a Cambridge-trained mathematician and is now the world's preeminent sperm whale expert. He teaches at Dalhousie University, and he has conducted probably 20 or 30 years' work on sperm whales. He's written this wonderful book called Sperm Whales, Social Evolution in the Ocean. It's very dry, full of facts and figures and graphs, and I read sort of all 370 pages of it. And I got to the final two pages, and he starts discussing whale culture, sperm whale culture. He says, well, they probably have a matrilineal culture passed down through the generations. Not only that, the size of the brain indicates to me that I believe they may have their own religion. Well, this is from a Cambridge-trained mathematician. You know, it's just like Richard Dawkins saying sort of dodos believe in God. I dropped the book at that point. But what Whitehead actually rationalises is that the sperm whale, which actually has the largest brain of any animal that's ever lived, the brain structure is very, the cortex is very convoluted. That means that there's a lot of surface area to the organ. And that apparently indicates high intelligence or capability of intelligence. And his reasoning is that if you've got an animal which is possessed of this brain, which all it has to do is eat or mate, what else does it do with its time? Does it start to rationalise its place in the world? And that's where he's sort of made this conclusion. I mean, it's a remarkable conclusion. And it just shows you, I think, one of the most things you talk about the science of the whale, this is utterly in its infancy. You know, we have no idea. There are entire species of whale, big beaked whales, which are the same species as the whale that came up the Thames in 2006, entire species which we only know from their skeletons. So huge animals out there swimming the sea we've never seen alive.
Which are still living?
Absolutely still living. There's probably undiscovered species of whale even living. It's extraordinary.
Of course, one of the things they do is talk to each other, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, sperm whales in particular, I mean, all whales probably communicate in various ways, but sperm whales have a series of clicks which vary in tone and frequency. And actually, how Whitehead has worked out that discrete populations of whales, sperm whales, actually travelling sort of probably next to each other, have different dialects of clicks. They speak in different dialects. We don't know what they're saying.
So now what about the future of the whale? I mean, we hear dire predictions of what's going to happen to the whole of marine life.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, with films like The End of the Line around and certainly this new film, The Cove, which is about the Japanese dolphin harvest, which is absolutely horrifying. You know, 23,000 dolphins being slaughtered in Japan each year, some of them selected for a dolphin area around the world. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of historical context here. I mean, we do very much, and I'm very much against the Japanese whaling fleet, which is operating in the Southern Ocean, which is a whale sanctuary, and it's utterly reprehensible. And we had last week the meeting of the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, trying to consider the attempts of Japan to widen overt commercial whaling. But you have to look at it in a historical context. After the Second World War, we dropped two atomic bombs in Japan. The Allied powers, occupying powers of Japan, used the decommissioned Japanese naval fleet, turned it into a whaling fleet, sent it out to feed the people whose, you know, livelihoods we'd reduced to, you know, almost starvation. So, you know, this is the one reason why the Japanese are turning around and saying, you know, at one point you tell us to go out and sort of, you know, feed our children whale meat, and now you're telling us not to do it. So there are cultural and historical reasons for this ongoing impasse, which is tragic because, as ever, the victim is the whale.
Yes. Apart from writing about whales, you've written about Victorian sects with a CTS. You've written about, you've done a catalogue of the Pet Shop Boys, haven't you? What exactly are you?
I don't know. It's very difficult to tell sometimes. I do kind of like reinvent myself with every book. And every book that I write is, for me, an obsession. You know, I mean, the Leviathan took me 5 years to write. All my books take, you know, an equal amount of time, really. So I think, you know, I have, I pick up these obsessions. And every book to me is the subject to me is utterly, you know, fascinating, and I never leave them. You know, I may be writing about Wales now, but I still have these children, these books I've written about, you know, 1920s aesthetes, or, as you say, Victorian sort of utopian sects. It's like they're like children, you know, you send them off and they have their own little lives, and they come back to you and you sort of go and do a little lecture about them or whatever, or something else happens, and they're a little brood that you have.
So what is your next child going to be? Is it going to be a boy or a girl, or indeed a whale?
Well, I don't quite know, because the trouble is that of all my subjects, Wales is one which reaches furthest back into my childhood, and kind of reaches furthest forward into the future in a way, because for me, it's been the most intense emotional sort of real ride, actually, in an adventure writing about this, because you'd not often, when you're writing a book, do you come so closely in contact with your subject, or is your subject so elusive and such a powerful image? And so for me, I actually haven't got anything in my head. All I have in my head is the whale. And it's a big subject. I can't see past it at the moment.
Well, let's hope that sooner or later it begins to move over and leave some space for something else. Thank you very much, Philip, for coming in.